This is Our Voices. I'm Mario Trimble. In order to be a place where everyone in our community feels valued and connected, we first have to ensure everyone believes they belong. These are Our Voices, a joint podcast production from the Colorado and Denver Bar Association's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity Joint Steering Committee. Our Voices shines a light on the unique stories, experiences, and backgrounds of our member leaders so that we can help each other walk together. Scott Labar is an accomplished litigator who attributes his success in part to his disability, blindness. Since 1998, Scott Labar has owned and operated the Labar Law Offices PC, specializing in employment law, disability rights, Social Security claims, estate planning, Randolph Shepard Act cases, and business law. Prior to that, he was general counsel for the National Federation of the Blind, or NFB, of Colorado, where he specialized in laws affecting the blind and disabled. A native of Minnesota, Scott is also president of the National Association of Blind Lawyers and serves as vice chairman of the board of directors for the Colorado Center for the Blind. Scott sat down with our own Mallory Revel and Linda Moss to talk about his experiences as a leader in the legal community, being an advocate for the blind, and how his introduction to the National Federation of the Blind changed his career track from international business management to law. And if you listen closely, Scott may even reveal his secret vice manifested during the pandemic. Please enjoy this engaging interview with Scott Labar.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Our Voices. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast today. I'm Linda Moss. I'm a family law attorney with Coombe, Curry, Rich, and Jarvis, and I'm here with Mallory Revel, who's a criminal attorney with Foster, Graham, Milstein, and Kalischer. And today we have the distinct pleasure of interviewing Scott Labar of the Labar Law Offices. Scott, welcome to our podcast, and thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I am honored to be here.
Scott, we're so happy to talk with you today. And as you may or may not know, our podcast is all about you. So what we want to do today is just talk to you about who you were, who you are, and who you're going to be. So let's start with who you were. Where were you born?
I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and grew up in a suburb of St. Paul called Woodbury, where my parents still live.
Do you have any siblings?
Yes, I have one brother. He's younger. I'm 52 as of this recording, and I don't know when this will go out, but I assume I'll still be 52. My brother is younger. He lives now in Duluth, Minnesota, with his wife. So that's my brother, so my parents and my brother are still in Minnesota along with a lot of relatives.
But you didn't want to be in Minnesota anymore?
No, you know, I went to college in Minnesota, to St. John's University, which is in Collegeville, Minnesota. Great name for a college town. Then I went to the University of Minnesota Law School, and I graduated in 1993. And I moved to Baltimore, where I worked for a little over a year at the headquarters of an entity called the National Federation of the Blind. Then I moved here to Colorado in 94 when a job opportunity came up. And honestly, I've never wanted to move from Colorado. I've had many opportunities to move elsewhere and take on other jobs, but I have turned all of them down, and I never can imagine moving out of Colorado. So I think I'm here to stay.
Who would ever want to move out of Colorado?
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm from New Jersey, and I came to Colorado, and my family still asks when I'm coming back. And I'm like, you're crazy.
You know, it's funny. It's rare when you run into, even in our legal profession, it's rare when you run into somebody who's actually a Colorado native.
It is really rare. And Mallory, where are you from?
I'm from all over because my dad was in the military, but I refer to Kansas City as home, so not a native.
See, there you go.
Yeah, we encounter those very few natives and treasure them. But regardless, so you grew up in Minnesota. What was that like?
Well, I think it's fair to say my first the first part of my childhood, I had a quote unquote normal childhood, growing up in a suburb of St. Paul, and with my family and doing all the things, you know, a young boy would do, played sports, baseball probably was my favorite. And I did all of those kinds of things. And then, when I was 10 years old, I had a virus and the virus attacked my eyes and, left me blind. So, I kind of think about my childhood in two parts. One is the part just growing up as a quote-unquote normal kid, and then going blind. And at the time, you know, I went blind, I had, I think, all of the same stereotypes and misconceptions about what being blind means. And so I thought it was a real tragedy that I wouldn't really be able to do much at all with my life, that I would be poor, that I would have to rely on the charity of others. And the reason that I thought that is I remember very distinctly, you know, the various popular television shows of the time. And every time they displayed somebody who was blind, that person was poor. That person was selling pencils on the street corner. That person was reliant on the charity of others. And so I thought that's what my life would be. And glad to say that, you know, when I went back to school, I went back to my local neighborhood elementary school, and I got supplemental services there. What do I mean by supplemental services? Well, I got I learned how to read and write Braille. I learned at that time, you know, how to type on a regular typewriter so I could create print, you know, documents. I learned how to get around using a cane, a white cane, and learned how to travel independently. And I was able to, you know, stay, fortunately, in my same grade, learn what I needed to learn. And I did very well in school after I went blind. What's interesting is, at least now that I reflect back on it, is when I was a kid with sight, you know, I didn't do very well in school. In fact, my parents and teachers were always complaining about how poorly I was doing and that I could do better. And when I went blind, it really sort of kicked me in the rear end. And I realized, I don't know that I realized it consciously as I think about it now, but something in me kicked in and said, listen, you got to try harder and you got to show that you can compete. So I became a good student, and I did very well academically, and I did everything I could think to do. I was on the wrestling team in high school and was very active in student clubs and whatever. And I was trying to demonstrate that, hey, even though I was blind, I could live a normal life. The problem that I had in that time period in my life is that I didn't really know successful blind people. All the blind people I had been introduced to were not doing very well. They were relying on government benefits. They were unemployed, and there were a lot of issues. And so I didn't have a lot of hope. Even though I was doing well in school and all that kind of stuff, I didn't know what I would do. And when in 1986, when I graduated high school, I met the organization that I now do a lot of work for, but I met the National Federation of the Blind because I won an academic scholarship, and my life changed because I met successful blind people. I met blind people who were doing what they wanted to do with their lives on their terms, and so that changed. That really did change my life, you know, when I went to college, I first thought I was going to get into international business management. And I was, you know, a Spanish major and a business major. And I thought that's what I was going to do. But what I realized is that I had a real tough time once I got very advanced in Spanish. I had a tough time getting materials, accessible materials in Spanish. Now, what do I mean by accessible materials? Well, in that day and time, that really meant one of a couple of things: books in Braille, or it meant, you know, getting books on Believe it or not, some of these people probably have never seen one of these that are listening right now, but a cassette tape, books on cassettes, or even before that on records, something you call a vinyl record, or even sometimes flexible plastic records. And so that's how I got my stuff. Or I would hire readers, people just to verbally read out loud for me. Usually what I did was sent readers off with my material and a tape recorder and said, here, record this, because invariably what I would do is when I got the tapes back, I would speed them up because I could read and listen a lot faster than what people can actually speak. So anyway, the reason I bring that point up is I was stopped from doing one of the things I wanted to do because I couldn't get those accessible materials. And it really had to do with a legal problem. Because of copyright law at that time, we couldn't get accessible materials across international borders, and we had a very difficult time converting printed works into accessible materials because you would have to get the permission of the copyright holder, and that would often take a long time. So, you know, I would have to sometimes literally wait months, if not years, to get the same book that somebody who didn't, you know, who wasn't blind, who was sighted or whatever, could get, you know, instantly. So the reason that's significant to my life is I would later in my legal career work on something called the Marrakesh Treaty, which altered international copyright law so that both countries, individual countries that sign on to the treaty, would agree to change their domestic law to allow entities on a nonprofit basis to turn books into accessible books without the permission of the copyright holder. And the treaty also provided for the exchanging of accessible books and accessible works across international borders. That treaty was adopted in 2013. I worked on it for several years prior to it. I'm still working on it now. So part of my legal work is in the area of international policy in the copyright arena. You know, when I did copyright stuff in law school, I never thought I would find a practical use for it. But guess what? So I've been talking for a while, so maybe you have a question.
Yeah, it sounds like your passion has kind of taken you to a variety of different legal areas, which is really interesting that you have, you know, sort of found an area of law that that you want to focus on. But at the same time, it's pretty much every area of law that that touches, you know, your main issue. So it sounds to me like you've put a lot of energy and focus into not only finding successful blind people who are role models to you and who can kind of combat that image that I think built up for you as a child of, you know, unsuccessful blind people. So how important is it for you to continue finding those role models and also to make yourself a role model for other people?
It's critically important because even though we have come, I think, a long way as a society, and even though the Americans with Disabilities Act has been around for 30 years now, it was adopted in 1990, we still have a long way to go. Blind people face an unemployment rate of over 60%. Blind children struggle still today to get the education that they need. Blind people and people with disabilities are among the poorest in our country. So we still have a ton of work to do. And so because I've been lucky, and I really do believe I've been very fortunate in my life, because I've been able to access the resources I need, and because I had the support of role models through the National Federation of the Blind that I needed and still need, I'm definitely committed to spreading that message and that hope to other people who are blind. not only here in the United States, but all throughout the world, because even though the conditions I described for you are pretty bad here in the U.S., for those of us who are blind, it's even worse in the rest of the world. And so I am very, you know, passionate about trying to make a better life for all of us, and especially those of us who are blind. And so I carry that forward in all the work I do. I mean, I'm beyond being very active in the National Federation of the Blind, as both a legal representative for the organization, and doing my professional work for the organization. I also volunteer as a volunteer leader in the Federation. So I spend a lot of time. But I also get involved outside the Federation, because even though we can help each other as blind people in our own organization, we have to get out there in society and show folks that, hey, listen, you know, those of us who are blind, or anybody with a disability, given the right opportunity, given the right resources, we can live the life we want. And that actually, you know, live the life we want is the motto of the National Federation of the Blind. So I've been very active in my profession. I've been very active, for example, in the American Bar Association. I've been a member of the ABA for, 28 years. I first joined when I was a law student at the University of Minnesota, so I guess I joined in 1992. And I've had many, many different roles in the ABA. My most, I guess, significant recent role is for 3 years I served a term on the American Bar Association Board of Governors. And that ended just last year in 2019. I have many other roles now. I've been active over time in the DBA and, you know, the CBA, especially when I was a young lawyer. I was on the executive council and one of the executive officers of the Denver Bar Association Young Lawyers Division. And now my role in the DBA is I serve as a delegate to the American Bar Association House of Delegates. So the reason I've gotten and so involved in the ABA is, again, to try and show people that, you know, those of us who have disabilities and are lawyers have a place, have a role to play. And anyway, so that's a little bit about, you know, about what I've been doing currently.
And you're clearly very passionate about bettering the lives of blind individuals. Is that passion what led you specifically to the law?
You know, I think it is. I think what I realized in college, and I guess the way that I kicked the tires on the legal profession, is I did an internship at a law firm in college and thought, hey, this could be pretty cool. And what I realized about getting a law degree is, you know, you really can do so many things with a law degree. It really is a great sort of liberal arts education that you can apply to so many areas of life. Because in my legal work, you know, I've done everything from litigating cases, taking them to trial, you know, arguing before appellate courts and state Supreme Courts. I've never argued yet in front of the United States Supreme Court, but who knows, maybe someday. But I can do so much more. I can affect policy. As I said, you know, I was involved with this treaty negotiation for the Marrakesh Treaty, and my law degree helped a lot because I could understand the issues, think about them appropriately, write the arguments, and write the language that needed to go into the treaty. It allowed me to do so much, and all of those tools and skills that I learned going through law school and as a lawyer have helped me, you know, be a leader in the National Federation of the Blind and helped me really change a lot of things, I think, for the better. So, you know, that I was driven to law school because of my involvement, and it has allowed me to, I think, make a difference.
And speaking of law school, one of our favorite questions for our guests is, what was your law school experience like?
You know, it was good. I mean, now that I reflect on it, it's kind of funny because I, you know, in college, I was very active and I was a very good student. And I was, you know, I always took more classes than I needed to take. And I was in student government and I did this and I did that. And what I realized when I first got to law school, it was that I kind of was a little burnt out on academics. So I kind of wish I would have taken what everybody now calls a gap year, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason that's funny for me is because I've got an 18-year-old son who's a senior at Cherry Creek High School here in the metro area, and he's talking about, well, you know, I need a gap year, Dad. Well, I don't know if I needed a gap year when I was graduating from high school, but so my son will be graduating in the spring from Cherry Creek, and my daughter is a sophomore there. Law school, you know, it was good. It was interesting. I'm not sure, honestly, if I'm the biggest fan of the Socratic method in that way of teaching. And unfortunately, sometimes I thought was a way of shaming some students. But you know, law school really gave me a lot of skills, information. I wish it would have given me a little bit more knowledge about how to actually practice law. And I know that the current way of thinking is more directed in that direction. But overall, you know, law school was a good experience. And the University of Minnesota, I've got to say, was a really good place to go to law school. I thought we had some really high-quality professors, but they supported me in the way I needed to be supported and to help me be successful. And what I meant by that is, you know, they gave me the support and help that I needed when I needed it, but didn't try to give me too much support or help when I didn't need it. So I found it to be overall a good experience.
That's a really interesting point when you say that they gave you the support you needed and they didn't give you too much support. Can you give an example of that? Or what do you think that might have looked like? Had you experienced that in previous educational settings?
I was fortunate in some ways because when I went to St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, it's a small private liberal arts school, and they didn't have lots of resources for, you know, what many schools call disabled student resource offices or whatever. The beauty of that was that if I knew what I wanted and what I needed, I could get it. And no sort of bureaucratic program of services and aids and other resources were sort of hefted or foisted or forced on me. I was able to control my education. And so what happens sometimes is when, you know, systems, universities, colleges, whatever, create these systems, they kind of create a system where they, you know, they try to get everybody the same exact kind of assistance, and you're limited to whatever they are providing, and you don't have a lot of control over the services you need or don't need. And my experience at Minnesota was not that way. If I needed some assistance from their Disabled Student Services office, I was able to get it and get it in the way that I needed it. But if I didn't need something, they weren't trying to, you know, force it on me. And that for me, that was a real critical issue because, you know, once you go to work, once you get in the legal profession, there really are no equivalents, if you will, to the Disabled Student Service Office. You need to be the one to know what is required, what you need, and what to ask for. So it was a great experience, I think, in that way. In other words, it empowered me. It didn't limit me or try and put me into a certain box, if that makes sense.
It does. And speaking of useful, empowering support, if you could take the opportunity to educate people, what's one thing that you wish that people would do when they meet you?
The biggest thing that I wish people would do is not make assumptions about the limitations of my or anyone else's disability. And don't be afraid to ask questions if you don't really know or understand. I think the assumption that I always run into is that I need a lot more help with this or that than I really do, or a misunderstanding about the kind of help I really need as opposed to what you think I might need. So I guess what I'm asking is for people to come to the issue of disability with an open mind and an open heart, and not assume. You know, the biggest thing that I always got being in the legal profession is, how are you going to do? You can't do all the reading. You know, you won't be able to keep up with the materials. So therefore, I'm not going to hire you. I can't tell you, you know, what troubles it really was. And when I was going through law school, I was fortunate enough to get into a very good law school. The University of Minnesota Law School is a quote unquote tier one law school. And, you know, we had firms coming to our campus all the time, big, huge firms. And, you know, medium and smaller ones as well. But, you know, they would come looking for us. And a lot of my colleagues would go to these big firms and get these great opportunities. And so we would have these on-campus interviews. And, you know, many times I just remember walking into the door of walking into whatever conference room and you know, sitting down at the table and they didn't know what to do. It was clear that they were just totally blown away by the fact I was blind, and they really didn't know what questions to ask. And, you know, I never got an offer from any of those large firms. And it's because of the assumptions they made about what my limitations are. And quite frankly, with respect to accessing information, that really, that's not a barrier. We can devise systems and create resources so that blind people and other folks with print disabilities have access to everything, especially in this technological age, mm-hmm. Because everything now is born digital. And if it is presented in a way that my assistive technology can access it, I can get access to the same information that you can just as quickly. And, you know, I use the main way that I access electronic information is through what's called screen reading software. It's software that takes the printed information and verbalizes it in synthesized speech. In particular, I use something called JAWS for Windows. And with JAWS, I speed it up really fast. You know, I can read documents at 500 words a minute. So if I can get access to that document, then I can read it maybe more efficiently than you can. And the same thing with access to websites and emails and what have you. And there are in the world, what are called World Wide Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which tell people how to create information technology that is accessible with assistive technology. However, a lot of entities don't do that. And so even though I've got this great technology, I still can't get access. Let me give you a great example of that. If somebody takes an image, takes a document, scans it in as an image, and then sends it to me, I can get the document, but when I open it up, all my JAWS says is, you know, empty document. Mm-hmm. But if they create the document in the right way, per the accessibility guidelines, then I can take that same PDF, open it, and read it. So anyway, I know I went off on a little bit of a tangent, but...
No, that's great information. And I was wondering, has the practice of law for you become markedly easier
with the advent of new technology, and you know, what has that looked like for you?
Well, it has, and it hasn't in some regards. For example, as long as the information that I'm seeking is accessible, I can get at it right away. I can do it all independently. Whereas back in the days when I was in law school, a lot of the printed information really was just in print, and wasn't necessarily born electronically. And so I had to use other methods. I had to hire a lot of readers, to verbally read stuff out loud. In fact, what I would often have to do in law school, and I did this in college as well, is I would ask the professor, hey, can you give me a minute or two to see if I can find some readers? So what I would do is I would say to my classmates, hey, listen, would you like to earn X dollars an hour, whatever it was then, reading material you're supposed to read anyway? And so I could hire readers that way. But nowadays, I don't really need readers as much because I try to get access to it electronically. And on the occasion that for some reason I can't, I have an assistant. And so I will ask my assistant to read something or to convert it into an accessible electronic document. Because honestly, with my jaws, I can read things a lot faster than she can read verbally. So it is easier in one sense. However, when people do not make websites accessible per the WCAG guidelines and the other guidelines, something known as Section 508 standards, it's frustrating because I can't use that website and can't access the information. And, you know, today, in today's world, more than ever, those of us who are blind need access to information, and if it's not accessible, then we have problems accessing jobs and accessing education. But if it is accessible, then, you know, we have great opportunities in those arenas. So it's gotten better in many ways because everything is born digitally in terms of information. We conceivably and theoretically have access to it or should have access to it, but we struggle to get entities to think about actually structuring their information technology so that it really is accessible to all.
Can you tell us a little more about accessibility guidelines and how we can create documents that are most easily accessible?
Well, as I say, there are industry standards out there, and so the best way to look for it is really anybody can do Google searches that say something like, how do I create an accessible document? Let me give you a simple example. Okay, so, you know, everybody who creates letters or briefs or whatever, you're doing on some kind of word processor. Almost, you know, a huge percentage of the time people do it in Word. And so you create these files, but then what you see happens is somebody takes a brief, let's say, prints it, and then they take that printed document and they literally scan it in as an image and then make a PDF. Because, for example, courts almost uniformly, or a large majority of them, when they want you to file something electronically, they want it in a PDF form. Okay, well, the problem with just scanning the image in is that I'm not going to be able to access it because it's a picture. And my jaw says this is a picture. This isn't a document. So what people don't understand is straight out of Word, you can convert a Word document directly into PDF. You don't have to print it out and then scan it back in. If you do it that way, then I'm going to be able to access it. So that's a very simple example of how to do it. It's kind of funny because, usually those of us in society mostly don't pay attention to executive orders coming out of the governor's office. But when this pandemic hit, a lot of us did want to pay attention to those executive orders. And what the governor's office was first doing with those executive orders is printing them out, having Governor Polis sign them, and then they just scanned it in and put it on the website. Well, guess what? I couldn't read those orders. And some of the work I was doing with some of my clients required that I understand the executive orders. So we talked to them. They changed their practice, and now all the executive orders that are up there are perfectly readable and accessible. So that's kind of a long answer to your question. But there are industry standards out there, the WCAG guidelines that I talked about, the Section 508 guidelines, and you can search for those things.
Okay, thank you. So 2020 has obviously been a challenge for everyone. Have you faced any particular challenges that may be unique to you?
Well, I think we've, faced a couple that are unique to blindness, for example. Just those, inaccessible information, which has been a barrier before the pandemic, but has taken on real importance during it. So that's been one barrier. And then the other interesting barrier has been, with regard to testing, a lot of the testing for the virus is drive up. Well, those of us who are blind, don't drive. We use other means. We get somebody to drive us. We take an Uber, take a Lyft, take public transportation. But during a pandemic, and when you think you might be, potentially sick or having the virus, you don't want to expose others to to the virus. So that's been kind of an interesting challenge. For me personally, I've had the same challenges everybody else has had, trying to stay healthy, trying to stay safe, making sure my family is okay and healthy. I am fortunate in that I have a job that, as long as I have access to the internet, phone line, and so on, and a place to work, a safe place to work, I'm fine. For over 300 days now, I've been down here in my basement where I'm talking to you from right now, working. So I've been fortunate in that regard. Before this pandemic, I flew a lot because my clients are all over the country. And I do the international work that I was talking about earlier. And because I've been so involved in the ABA, I traveled a lot for the ABA. Well, it's been over 300 days. I haven't been on a plane. So that's been really weird for me, to tell you the truth. I think my family is pretty sick of me and hopes that the pandemic ends soon so that I'm traveling again.
have you developed any vices in 2020?
Vices. Well, not any real new vices, other than I have spent a lot more time than I ever did before on Netflix or Hulu and those kinds of things. So I guess you could say I've wasted my time, rewatching old shows or some new shows, and it's probably not the most productive use of my time, but it's been enjoyable at least.
And self-care is important. So I have to ask, what has been your pick for either Netflix or Hulu for 2020? Another guest claimed Tiger King, so you cannot claim Tiger King.
I won't because my pick, and I'm going back a ways, but during this pandemic, have rewatched twice all the episodes of The West Wing. That's a show from, I think it started in 1999 and ended in 2006. And so that's been my favorite.
Very nice. So we always like to ask our guests kind of what's next for them. Word on the street is you have been a wrestler in your past. Obviously, you're now a lawyer. You've been a treaty maker. What else are you looking to conquer in your life?
Wow. That's really a tough question. Ultimately, continuing to be around as my kids grow up and go off to college, and maybe someday they'll have families of their own. So I guess I would be looking, someday would like to be a grandpa, to tell you the truth, because then I can do what my parents did to my, did to and for my children, and mostly to us by spoiling them. That'll be fun someday. But, you know, professionally, I've had lots of different thoughts, to be quite honest with you. As I say, I've been very active in the ABA. So one thing that I continue to consider is, you know, do I want to keep advancing my leadership in the ABA or in a local bar? You know, for example, the American Bar Association has never had a blind president, and I know of no former president of the ABA that had a obvious or a disability that they disclosed. I would guess that the Colorado Bar has never had, you know, a person with a disability as president that I'm aware of. Who knows? Maybe some stuff in bar leadership like that. Maybe I've thought, toyed around with the idea of maybe someday seeking a position on the bench. Which bench? Don't know. I don't know. Those are things that I fool around with in my mind. You know, so that's the future. Something like that.
Since you already have put some pressure on your kids today, do either of them have any interest in the law?
I know my son doesn't, because all the schools he's trying to get into for a college are engineering schools that have engineering programs. In specific, he really wants to go into aerospace engineering. So he's, you know, looking at places like CU Boulder and Cal Poly, and he's applied to all those places. And so I don't think my son will. Now, my daughter is another case. I think there is potential for her to want to go to law school. She seems to have that kind of set of skills and interests academically. And so who knows?
What does your family enjoy doing together?
Well, I would say that what we've enjoyed during the pandemic, you know, we'll watch movies together or play a lot of different kinds of card games. So that's what we enjoy, pandemic times. Otherwise, I think it's fair to say that we've enjoyed traveling as a family, both, you know, domestically and internationally. My wife is originally from Armenia, so we've traveled from as a family back to Armenia a few times. They've enjoyed that. I've enjoyed taking them to various places here in the United States for, you know, when I go to an ABA meeting, let's say, they'll come with. They've been with me in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle, wherever. I would say they definitely have enjoyed that. Those are some of the things we enjoy doing as a family. And another thing that we've really enjoyed over this last year and a half or so is having a puppy. Last May, we got a little Labradoodle named Mocha. So we very much have enjoyed as a family watching Mocha grow up. And it's been great having a pet, a family friend during this pandemic. It really has been wonderful. So
dogs have helped so many people through the pandemic. They're the absolute best.
Well, Labradoodles are great. She's been an amazing dog. She's been our pandemic puppy. She's not going to know what to do when we kind of go back to, you know, the before virus times. You know, I traveled a lot, so she wouldn't see me very much. And now she sees me all the time and demands that I play with her. And the same, you know, for the kids and my wife. They've been working, either going to school or working from home a lot. So she's spoiled. I don't know what she'll do when we're not around quite as much.
You were just talking about travel. Travel is one of my favorite means of self-care. Can you mention the importance of self-care perhaps in your life, in your practice, and what other means you enjoy?
Well, I think it is critically important to engage in activities that help you take care of yourself and give you perspective. And, you know, for me, when I travel, I just really enjoy being in new places, experiencing new restaurants, new locations, you know, and I guess for me, you know, for example, with my bar association work, yes, there's a lot of very important legal work we need to do through the bar association, work to support our profession, work to advocate for change in a lot of areas. But it's the friends, you know, the friends you meet and being able to see some really good friends a few times a year and spend quality time with them. That is incredibly important to me. And then, you know, the other things that I do, I enjoy reading. So I, you know, all kinds of different books, from interesting books on the, you know, human brain to, you know, spy thrillers and whatever. I'm reading right now, for example, John Grisham's new book. But I've also, at the same time, kind of going back and forth, been reading President Obama's first volume of his memoirs from being president. So I love reading and that kind of thing. And you know, one thing I kind of have missed, and I suppose I could have done something about this during the pandemic, but just haven't been very willing to do so. I really enjoy live music. And yes, there's, you know, there obviously a lot of that's been cut off, but there's been some of it, but I just really haven't wanted to put myself in public to expose myself to the virus needlessly. So when, you know, when we get out of this pandemic, I can't wait to, you know, go somewhere and really enjoy some live music again. So I really enjoy that. What else? Well, as I say, you know, during the pandemic, you know, recently I've been watching again a show from the 90s. I guess I like the 90s, but the show ER. I've been watching that again.
Plenty of episodes for the pandemic.
Yeah, it's got like 301 episodes or something. I don't know. So that's a little bit about what I've been doing.
Well, it sounds like you've got self-care pretty down pat, and I also cannot wait to get back to Red Rocks as soon as humanly possible.
That yeah, was a real, and you know,
real sad part of our year.
We live here in Centennial, near Arapahoe in Quebec, and we're literally about a mile away from Fiddler's Green.
Awesome.
And we can actually, you know, when they have concerts over there, we can hear it, and some nights very well. So anyway, so it's kind of cool to be in this area.
Well, Scott, we are winding down on time a little bit. So the last thing I'd really like to ask you is just, what do you want to tell everyone? What do you want everyone to know about you as a person, you as an attorney? What's your message?
Earlier, I referred to the motto of our National Federation of the Blind, and it is, you know, live the life you want. And that's what I want to tell everybody. You know, whatever you've got going in your life, if you're somebody with a disability, if you have other challenges, don't be afraid to dream. Don't be afraid to set goals and live the life you want, not the one that other people think you ought to live. I guess, you know, when I shuffle off my mortal coil someday, hopefully many, many, many years from now, but whenever that happens, I hope that I've made a difference in the world, that I've done something to make it better than the way I came into it. I'm glad that I'm proud to be a lawyer, because I think through our profession and the work that we do make life better for people in a lot of significant ways. And that's what I want to let people know, that I think being in law, it's a noble profession. And I think regardless of the area of law that you practice, you can make a difference, either as part of the quote-unquote regular work that you do or outside of the regular work that you do. So we should be proud of being lawyers. I want to, you know, 2020, thank God it's ending. From my perspective, there have been so many challenges and awful things that have happened. But I would like to think that lawyers have made a big difference in the world during these times of helping create and respect the rule of law. And that's what's keeping our society together. I guess I could go in a lot of different directions there, but I do think we have an important role to play, and I'm proud that we have been a part of making sure that the rule of law ultimately prevails. And so that those are the things I would like to say, I guess, in conclusion.
Awesome. And can you just give us a quick plug for your firm, let everyone know the best way to reach you and also the best resources for people who are looking for more information.
Well, sure. With regard to my law practice, you know, it's LaBar Law Offices. I have a website, LaBar Law, L-A-B as in baseball, A-R-R-E-L-A-W.com. And the best way to get a hold of me just, I think, is simply S-LaBar. At labarlaw.com. And so that's a little plug for my law practice. As I say, I do a lot of work in the area of employment law, and particularly employment discrimination, disability rights, and that international policy work in the area of copyright law that I mentioned. With respect to blindness, quite frankly, the best resource I can point you to is the National Federation of the Blind. Nationally, nfb.org, and locally, nfbco, for Colorado, obviously, .org. So those would be the best resources.
Thank you so much, Scott, for speaking with us today and for giving us all of this amazing information about yourself and about the world in general. We really, really appreciate your time and have had such a fun time talking to you.
Well, thank you so much. I very much have appreciated the opportunity. And wherever you are out there in the podcasting world, just stay safe and healthy.
Thank you so much, Scott. Such a pleasure.
This has been Our Voices. For more information on today's guest, or to get involved, please check out the CBA podcast page at cobar.org/podcast. That's cobar.org/podcast. This podcast series was created by members of the Colorado and Denver Bar Associations. Our Voices is a collaborative effort of the EDI Joint Steering Committee messaging team, including Mallory Revel, Linda Moss, Bonnie Schreiner, Mallory Hasbrook, Mo Watson, Mario Trimble, Courtney Holm, and Emmy Lopez, with our CBA Communications Team Director, Heather Folker, and Manager, Charles McGarvey. Our recording engineer is Rick Pontellion of Lionsbridge Recording. Our producer and editor is Courtney Holm, with theme and introduction by Mario Trimble. This podcast is made possible because of the support of the Colorado and Denver Bar Associations. On behalf of all of us, thanks for listening to Our Voices.